Welcome, and thanks for listening to Intrinsic Investigations. My name is Mr. Olivo, and I created this podcast because I've been fortunate enough over the last decade to see unique and thought-provoking projects happen in my classroom, and we wanted a place to showcase them. The true heart of this podcast lies not in the content discovered, but in exploring the personal stories of these young researchers as they journey through uncharted and unfamiliar intellectual terrain. By sharing their stories, we hope to normalize the challenges and frustrations that come with independent research, and also share those moments where students transcend the normal grind of the school day to discover concepts that range from the global to deeply personal. We will begin with a brief introduction to the student of focus, why they pick their topic, and discuss their growth over the course of the last year. It should be mentioned that the opinions expressed in this podcast in no way reflect the opinions of our school district, Bergen County Technical Schools and Special Services, or our school itself, Bergen County Technical High School Teterboro, or the College Board. The work detailed in this podcast was most likely completed in AP Capstone, but this podcast is in no way affiliated with the College Board. This is the final episode of Season 2. And it is going to be one that is focused on krill, marine heat waves, and the math with which to analyze them. And I'll let my guest introduce themselves. Addison, tell the audience a little bit about yourself before we
Hi,
get into this.
I'm Addison. I am currently a junior and a computer science major. And I thought that choosing the second search result on Illicit was a great way to do a research project.
But for the uninitiated, I know that I use that term often on this podcast. What is illicit.com?
It's a source finder. It uses AI, but instead of being an unethical goblin, it uses it to just help more accurately find the papers you're actually looking for.
Did you find it to be useful? Would you recommend it to other researchers out there?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's a great jumping off point when you're just like got to find something and then you see like what's being cited and you can like we're just finding a few starting papers that you can then go through the citation net from.
Okay.
Especially useful for me because I had to synthesize a bunch of different fields. More on that later.
Yeah. Well let's... What did you choose to explore in your AP research course?
Okay, so I chose to research marine heat waves and specifically Southern Ocean marine heat waves. There was the process to getting there was long. I wanted to do something with marine climatology. And so I literally just typed marine climatology into Illicit, and a lit review on marine heat waves was the second search result. This is a very not smart way to start a research project. None of you ever choose the second search result, please. I wanted to do something on marine climatology, so I found this lit review and this project went through several iterations. I wanted to do something related to subsurface effects of water that we can't detect with satellite data. Except, oops, I don't have a physics degree.
Not yet.
Or ever.
Okay.
I hate physics.
Well, I was trying to leave the door open, but okay.
I was going to do something with that. There were a couple other things that I don't remember, honestly. So I ended up settling on looking at adjusting the way we define marine heat waves based on what organisms in the Southern Ocean can actually tolerate. So this would be an adjustment specifically for our definition in the Southern Ocean. That was my project that I ended up settling on because it was something that it was feasible to do because it required just the data of the heat waves, which is easily accessible and definitely didn't require me getting a new hard drive. And then the only other thing it required is data on whatever organism I use to represent the ecosystem can actually tolerate. And that's just reading a lot of papers.
All right. Your work in seeing it evolve over the year, it seemed to be focused on obviously marine heat waves, but it, while it was It was math heavy. There's a good amount of mathematics in it. Mm-hmm. And that math seemed to be contextualized around looking at the biological impact of these marine heat waves to krill, and subsequently what happens when, like, if those krill were to die from these marine heat waves. You're currently in biology right now, correct?
Yeah, correct.
How did you build up the body of knowledge to try to explore this if you're currently in bio exploring this biological topic? Like, what did you already know beforehand, or what did you learn in bio to help you with this?
Okay, so first of all, I'm going to actually roll back a step and a half and explain why I'm doing krill to begin with.
Sure.
Okay, so there's something called an indicator species that is used in biology. You can't measure every single organism in an ecosystem. That's not possible. But what you can do is you can choose an animal or a certain set of animals or organisms, they can be plants too, to basically represent an aspect of your ecosystem. So for me, I chose Antarctic krill because I'm looking at how heat waves affect this marine life. And so I want to choose the thing that is affected by heat and that the rest of the ecosystem is very heavily dependent on. So I chose Antarctic krill because Antarctic krill are the food base of the ecosystem. And so what happens with temperature to them determines what happens, at least in large part, to the rest of the ecosystem, both the things they consume and, more arguably, more importantly, the things that consume them.
They're highly important in the trophic web of
the Southern Ocean. They are a keystone species. They are a keystone species. Well, to clarify, the trophic webs in the Southern Ocean are so small that everything is a keystone species.
Okay.
But they are the keystone of the keystone species.
It's a very sensitive environment.
Yes,
then.
It is an extremely sensitive environment.
And it seems as though your work is exploring a disruption to that sensitivity through heat waves.
So going back to the original question, I was doing this biology while also in biology class. So the way this happened is a couple things. First of all of the ecology stuff we did in bio was mm-hmm. actually much earlier in the year. And so, like, for example, way earlier in the year in bio, we did this paper on Antarctica, and I chose the fisheries biologist role for that because that was about Antarctic krill, because I knew I was going to be doing this in research.
Oh, okay.
And so I read a bunch of papers that I think I cited 7 papers for that project, 7 papers on krill. 3 of those made it into my final paper. Those helped build up my knowledge body on krill. And the other thing is just, I'm a massive nerd, especially when it comes to biology. And so going into this well before bio class, I had a pretty good understanding of the way ecosystems function. Like, I may have not known the specifics of how the Southern Ocean ecosystems, how their trophic webs connected, although I did also know some of that. But I had a good understanding of the ways that ecosystems work and how animals connect with each other. And how that forms, well, the entire ecosystem.
Yeah. Power to the nerds. This
agreed.
All right. So you had this body of knowledge that you had just explored outside of class. It seems like there was some overlap early in the year with what you were engaging with in biology.
Uh-huh.
What about the math that you later employed? Before we get into the mechanics of what you did, were you learning the math that you used on the spot for this project, or was there overlap with things that you've seen in other classes?
Sort of. So I think, what was it? Just a little bit before, like probably a month before, not a month, month and a half-ish. Month to a month, doesn't matter. Just before I started actually doing and writing out the math for this project, we had done specifically Riemann sums in AP Calculus. And Riemann sums are the thing I used for this project, not necessarily just because I knew it. I would have been entirely comfortable having to go learn new math, but it's more just looking at the type of data I had and the thing I was trying to do. Riemann sums are the best option I had available to me.
Okay.
They're really the best thing to use for this. And by best, I mean only. And so like the that's the basic mechanics of all the math I did. That's not the mechanics. That is the way I learned the mechanics of what I did. But I did also have to go learn some of my own math. Specifically, because I was working with data defined in other papers, and also the definition of a marine heat wave is based on an equation defined in another paper, which also that paper is the reason that the name Alistair J. Hobday will never leave my head.
Yes, we'll get into all this.
I apologize.
No, it's okay.
But understanding the math from those papers did take time, but it was time I was willing to invest because I really wanted to do this project. And I understood that, okay, the math I have to write out is not that complicated. It's basic integral calculus. And so if I can understand the math from these other papers, what I can do is I don't actually need to understand how to or I don't actually need to implement that math myself, but I can use that math to just understand what is going on so I can then write my math to work with that.
All right, and I'll try to make a note to myself to circle back to this idea of, I'm interested and curious about how you approach subject matter when you know very little about it and you haven't engaged with it before, but I'll save that to the end, because I do want to get into,
okay.
We seem to be dancing around with the nature of your work, and let's just get right into it. So what was your investigation? How did you carry it out?
Okay. So first of all, I mentioned earlier that I'm looking at adjusting how we define marine heat waves. So first of all, the way we define a marine heat wave is...
And by we, you mean the scientific community.
Yes. Yep. The royal we.
The royal we.
I guess... It would actually include me now because I did this.
Yeah.
It would actually include me now.
Yeah, you'd be in the group.
So the way marine heat waves are defined is with a percentile threshold. You have a certain percentile, and if the temperature rises above that percentile threshold for a certain amount of days, I believe 5 days, then it counts as a marine heat wave, and 5 consecutive days. And this threshold is seasonally varying, and it's calculated based on the temperature data of that specific location. So it's the percentile for temperature of whatever specific location you're looking at. So normally we use the 90th percentile threshold, but I was looking at, okay, well, organisms in the Southern Ocean are really bad at adapting to temperature shocks. So I was looking at, well, okay, do we need to maybe adjust this threshold? So what I actually tried to do is step one, find what organism I'm going to use. I explained this earlier. I used Antarctic krill.
Krill.
Because they're representative of the ecosystem. They're the food base.
Got it.
Et cetera, et cetera.
Makes sense.
Now, next thing I need to do is I wanted to quantify their thermal tolerance, because my thought was, well, if we're looking at whether we have to adjust the threshold, we need to know what the thermal tolerance of these animals actually is. The way I did this is just dive headfirst into a bunch of papers, dive right into the deep end, and just start reading a lot about Antarctic krill. I think I read probably... There are 32 citations in my paper. I think over 20 of them are krill papers. Some of them also have heat wave stuff. Some of those krill papers also have heat wave stuff in them. But over 20 of those papers are krill papers, because basically what it is, just read a bunch of papers, and what those papers are doing is looking at specific aspects of krill. So I can go I can look at a fatty acid analysis to see what they're eating at different times of year, and I can then go look at, okay, well, if they're eating those things at different times of year, what is the thermal tolerances of their food sources determine? And using this and using different factors, or for example, when larvae are overwintering under ice, what can larvae actually tolerate under that ice? Because larvae are critical for the survival of the species. And so basically what I do is I look at all these papers, and I look at each of these papers analyze a different aspect of these krill. And by quantifying what the thermal limits of each of those aspects are and how they change across seasons, I can put that all into a graph of krill's thermal tolerance. That's the basic way. From there, once I have that graph, it is just the very simple, take the graph, take the percentile threshold for specific coordinates, find the difference between them, and then calculate the 1% threshold, the 2%, the 3%, et cetera, from 1 to 100, and just see which one has the close, which percentile threshold is the closest to the krill thermal tolerance threshold just based on what's the difference between them. And that's the simple integral calc I discussed earlier.
And that's a good overview of the method.
That is
a podcast friendly
medium level overview of the math.
What did the math ultimately reveal about this problem?
So the math revealed something very interesting. It found that the closest threshold, the threshold that would most accurately match krill's thermal tolerance, was the 100th percentile. Now, there's kind of a problem there.
Yep.
You can't go above 100% of the temperatures. That's kind of physically impossible. And in fact, it found this not just one time, but for all three randomly selected coordinates I tested, it found that the 100th percentile was the most accurate. So, what that suggested is, that suggests a couple things. So obviously we can't actually use the 100th percentile because that would mean heat waves never happen. Everything is fine and dandy. We are good.
Which clearly
is not happening. The poles are warming four times faster than the rest of the planet.
Right. And your work is centered around Antarctica.
So, what I have to look is, okay, well, what does this actually mean? Okay, so it definitely means we do need to adjust the percentile threshold by some amount. But what should we actually bring it to if the number I'm getting here is physically impossible? Well, that suggests that we need to use a value in between them. Now, to roll back a little, the reason I don't think that my number is actually accurate is primarily there's missing data on these krill, and because there's missing data on these krill, and also because my thermal tolerance model was only considering krill and not other organisms, the thermal tolerance model is almost certainly not a giant, but a decent overestimate of how tolerant these animals actually are.
So currently there are, and that's okay, this happens with all research, you have some gaps in knowledge that are making it harder to make a
clear conclusion. The gaps in knowledge are not, I didn't understand the paper. The gap of knowledge is the papers don't exist, because it turns out harvesting krill sampling krill larvae under meters of ice in the winter is really hard and really expensive.
Is that something you see yourself doing in the future?
Oh, God, no.
Oh, okay. I didn't know if you were going to be the one to solve this puzzle.
No.
So even with the limitations of the availability of the data that you had, the conclusion drawn would be what?
Okay, so, well, I was getting there. So
yeah.
The idea is, okay, so if this is an overestimate, what other papers have actually suggested adjustments? And there's this one paper that I landed on called Fernandez-Barba et al., written by Fernandez-Barba et al. In 2024. My paper actually has some problems with that. I refute some methodological grounds of that paper. But basically my conclusion is, hey, I think this paper's Fernandez-Barba et al. Offhandedly, it's not the main point of the paper, suggested using the 95th percentile threshold to rule out situations in which we're not sure if there's heat waves because sea ice is covering the ocean for too long of the year. So I'm rejecting some of the way they got to that, but the ruling out of sea ice uncertainty is still a legitimate reason. Mm-hmm. And so what I'm suggesting is, okay, well, we clearly need to increase the threshold. This other paper has suggested a partially valid reason for increasing it to the 95th percentile, and then I have pretty clear evidence we do need to increase it by some amount. And so because of that, I basically am using the suggestion of, well, okay, let's increase it to the 95th percentile specifically as an interim while we get better krill data and make models that can consider more factors other than just krill. Part of the reason I didn't consider more factors is just time. Reading 20 krill papers already ate my life away. I didn't have time to do this for like two or three other animals.
On the topic of those other animals, what Do you have any other candidate animals of interest or not?
There's
not yet?
Especially algae, such as specifically diatoms. Diatoms I talk about a little because they're also the food sources for Antarctic krill. There's some plants, benthic plants, because benthic or seafloor foraging is something krill are kind of known to do, but it's also understudied. But krill are kind of overwhelmingly the keystone species of the Southern Ocean. About 70% of the Southern Ocean's biomass is krill.
Which is why you pick them.
Yes. So krill are sort of overwhelmingly the candidate, as in if you're going to choose just one, you got to pick those guys. But if you have the time to go research more than one, you really should. That's just time I didn't have.
Gotcha.
And so I had to go with one.
How does your work fit into the larger topic of climate change that's currently going on in the scientific community?
So this is really a tool for researchers to use. This is not a flashy thing. You're not going to see a press conference where everyone's excited that you discovered, oh, maybe we need to adjust a number a little bit. But this is a tool for researchers because the poles are warming 4 times faster than the rest of the planet. And so if we want to be able to protect ecosystems in these environments that are really sensitive to temperature changes and are also warming way faster than everywhere else,
right,
we need to accurately define what is actually happening to these organisms. And so that's what this is. This is a tool to help researchers define what is happening to these ecosystems and to these organisms, because by adjusting this threshold specifically for the Southern Ocean, we now have an idea of, okay, this is a more specific recommendation to just this region, which we can now use to better figure out what is happening to this region and then protect it, because the tools we're using are not insanely general, but are specific to the thing we actually need to analyze and protect.
And correct me if I'm wrong, I'm assuming then that means if you were to be doing like projections of population increase or like population dynamics of those krill, if you understand this problem better, you'll be able to make better predictions with larger data.
Sort of. The thing with population dynamics, and mind you, I'm not a population dynamics expert, is that generally population dynamics are really good, or figuring out population dynamics is something you do by analyzing general trends, specifically warming trends.
Mm-hmm.
Heat waves are really difficult to factor into those, at least to my understanding. Someone please correct me if I'm wrong. But heat waves are really difficult to factor into those specifically because heat waves are by nature anomalous. They are definitionally anomalous or abnormal events that exist outside of trends that you can consistently analyze. Although the thing you can analyze with heat waves is also that the trend is heat waves are more common and more extreme. That is something you can factor into it. But heat waves are more difficult to factor into estimates of population dynamics, but they are nonetheless still a consideration. And yes, this could be used not just for projections of population dynamics, but also projections of trophic cascades.
That makes sense. We only have about 5 minutes left, so I want to just shift the question slightly to something I was going to ask about before. It seems like for this project, you had to do a good amount of heavy lifting in terms of filling in blanks that you did not know about in order to carry out this project. How did you go about trying to address those blind spots? Like, what were your strategies you weren't a krill expert before this started.
Yeah.
Your krill expertise, I guess, could be debated among the people who are super krill experts out there. But you
Lloyd
obviously
S.
know.
Peck, please contact me if you have problems with my work.
But you obviously know a lot more about krill. You know a lot more about applying mathematical concepts that you heard about in class. How did you deal with that?
Okay, so I'm realizing I say okay at the beginning
it's
of every
okay.
answer.
It's okay. It's a podcast.
I
just said it's okay in response to if you're saying okay.
So I have the benefit of, because I've been a very curious and very science-obsessed person my entire life, I have a very large knowledge base to work with to begin with. And what that large knowledge base has done is I've been reading papers for years. I have experience reading papers well before AP Research and its prerequisite class AP seminar. I have experience reading these papers well before that. And so...
Can I ask, when did you start reading peer-reviewed papers?
Probably, I think the first time I read a peer-reviewed paper was probably 7th grade, okay. Something like that.
That's young.
I read them. I sort of like would at least try to skim the ones I was capable of understanding in my free time because I like science.
All right.
Yes, I'm a giant nerd, as established earlier. So, but my knowledge, my knowledge base that I've just gained from reading stuff, and my knowledge and also just my experience reading papers meant two things. One, the knowledge base meant I kind of knew what I was looking for from the get-go. Even if I didn't know the answer to the thing I was looking for, I knew the thing I needed to find. Like, as I mentioned earlier, I understood going into this a lot of general ecosystem dynamics. And because I understand general ecosystem dynamics, I know what I'm actually looking for going into trying to figure out krill things. The second thing is my experience reading papers and understanding science more broadly means that I'm generally quite good at, if I don't understand something, just jumping right into the deep end and beginning to read papers. Like, I'll do like a 2-second Wikipedia search or something just to like get a tiny base of like, okay, what's going on?
To get a foundation.
But yeah, to get a foundation. But then from there, I'm pretty good at being able to just jump into the deep end, start reading papers. And even if the paper makes no sense to me at that moment, just pin it, go through the citation web, and like slowly build my knowledge from these different papers. And then I can synthesize it all to understand what's going on in all of these papers, including even that original one that I might have not understood completely.
That's great that you seem unafraid to do that. I feel for some students that could be extremely intimidating.
It definitely was intimidating for me this time, although that was partially because of the pressure of like, oh, this is a class. I need to do this for a grade now. But
well, yeah, that's there too.
No, I mean, okay, I'll clarify. I'm doing this out of passion. If I just wanted the grade, I did not have to do any of this. But like just the pressure of, oh, there are grades still involved in this process. So that increases the stress, the intimidation of it a tiny bit, but it still very much is something I'm not that afraid of. No.
Great. The last question I'm going to ask you is, you seem to have a wide knowledge of scientific concepts. Uh-huh. How do you do science? Like, how do you engage? Like, this could be in really any scenario that you find yourself actively engaging in the process of doing lab work. It could be in a kitchen. Like, where do you find yourself doing science? Like, utilizing what you know about science for something, like a product almost?
So, in terms of utilizing what I know about science in terms of functional applications, this is probably far and out the most I've ever actually had to use it. A lot of my science knowledge, really the most of my life, other than helping me get good grades, has been kind of a repository of things I never use.
Well, you used it this year.
Yeah, no, yeah. I mean, prior to this. But the way I engage with science is I just really love learning, so I will learn things. I will learn science just for the sake of learning it, and then I'll just like keep that in the back of my head. And if something comes up that I just like go, oh, this relates to that. From that point, my brain will jump like, oh, I know this other thing. I can connect this to that. And even if I'm not saying this to anyone, what I'm sort of doing in my head is just connecting the scientific knowledge I already know of to then the real world things I'm seeing. And that helps further build that scientific knowledge and reinforce those connections. And that's sort of been my way of engaging with science. I've done this for over 10 years. And having done this for so long, what it means is that now, once I'm doing science, like in this class for this paper, I'm like, oh, I have experience taking all the scientific knowledge I have, connecting it to the real world things I'm actually seeing and the things I'm doing, even if those connections are just being made in my head and never going anywhere beyond that. And so I can take those, not just the actual individual connections I built, but also the skill of doing that and apply that to what I'm working on, this paper, which is also part of the reason I'm good at jumping into the deep end and just starting to read papers. This is also something that was further heavily reinforced by AP Seminar, because that required us to make lots of connections and synthesize a lot of sources between papers.
What is some science that, as you're a junior right now, as you move into higher education, you get more opportunities, like this class offered you an opportunity, you dove in. Is there anything you want to particularly do as you enter college? Like, is there a particular application of science that you hope
biology
you get the opportunity
or particularly paleontology? Paleontology is a special interest of mine. It's been a special interest of mine my entire life. And
so, do you want to literally be out in Montana digging up fossils?
I'm not sure I can do that, but
okay.
More primarily because my back problems mean I would die.
Okay.
It's not that I have anything against being out in Montana digging up fossils. It's that my back would kill me.
Okay. So maybe like carbon dating or...
No, I'm much more of a... I'd love to do digs, but my back really won't let me. Maybe in the future. But I would... But that's a sign... Because that's my special interest, I really want to work on that. And more broadly, I just love biology generally. And so that's sort of what I see myself doing going forward. That's part of the reason that I also made this paper that was originally climatology, really more of a bioclimatology paper with all the krill stuff.
I see that. All right. Well, we got to wrap up because the bell's about to ring. But thank you for your time, and thank you for being our last interviewee.
thank you, too. It was great to do this.
All right. Awesome.